here. Here's my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome our callers from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. John Quirk. And Mr. Quirk has written extensively a number of books to his credit and articles. And of course, he teaches at a diplomatic school in Paris. I had met him at an international meeting quite recently. He has a home in Normandy. He has another home in Florida, and that's where he is right now, and he's good enough to come on with us, but he has a tremendous grasp of what is really going on in the world, far different than you're going to get from the media here in the United States, because, of course, the people in Europe know far more about what's going on than the people here. Mr. Quirk, now this diplomatic school, do people come from the Arab countries as well as from Christian countries to take the courses there?
Yes, a number of people are from Arab countries are ambassadors, military attachés, political officers, and commercial officers from Islamic countries.
Well, Chris, what is their feeling about what's going on? Are they concerned that we're heading towards some sort of a class of civilizations?
Yes, I think so. I think that even the secular Muslims that are pro-U.S. to a certain extent, they may not be pro-Israel, but they're pro-U.S., feel that radical Islam is gaining a foothold in many of these countries, either secretly or even through the political process like Hamas.
Well, of course, haven't we seen that recently, actually, in Egypt? Didn't the Muslim Brotherhood pick up an awful lot of seats in the government, even though it's an outlawed party?
Yes, they picked up a lot of seats. You're exactly right. They're starting to insinuate themselves into the political process. And then, of course, they have a covert, clandestine program.
Men who are Muslims into the arms of the radicals. Is this really happening?
Yeah. Yes, you put your finger on it, Stan. The big problem is there are literally millions of young Muslim men, whether it's in Egypt or the Sudan or Yemen or Saudi Arabia, Jordan, that are out of work. And they go to both the madras schools and the Wahhabi schools. They study the Quran 12, 14 hours a day. They don't study engineering. They don't study math as a rule. They don't study political science. And then the imams that control them kind of direct them towards hatred to the West, hatred against America in particular, and hatred against Israel. And this is a growing problem for the West.
And isn't there certainly a tremendous antagonism towards America? Because in many instances, we support the authoritarian Muslim governments that, of course, keeping these people down.
Yes, it's several fold. One, many of the young Muslims and even the people in the political parties do not like, and they cite this constantly, the U.S. support of Israel. The second thing, in countries like Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Egypt, and so on, they don't like the fact that secular Muslim governments are repressive. They don't let people practice their, what Islamics would say, the freedom of their religion, and put a lot of people in jail.
Why don't you hold that thought? We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. John Quirk, and Mr. Quirk teaches at a diplomatic school in Paris. He's written extensively. If we went down, we wouldn't have any time for the program. We went through all of his credits and all the books and other articles that he's written. He has a home in Normandy. He has a home in Florida, and we were fortunate enough to meet him at an international meeting recently, and he agreed to come on to our program. We've just been talking about the attitude of the Muslims. So there are many secular Muslims out there. In other words, they may be Muslim, nominally, but they're not radical Muslims as we would think of Al-Qaeda or of Osama bin Laden. But increasingly in the Muslim world, Mr. Quirk was saying that young men out of work are being oppressed by their governments, which are supported by the United States, are turning to this radical form of Islam, which really was a very, very minimal thing, prior to America's involvement in recently. We had the Muslim Brotherhood, we had the Wahhabi faith, but this was not a major problem, but now it threatens the very stability of the whole of the Middle East. What about Pakistan? My concern is that Musharraf, the president there, could, I should say the dictator, because really they're not elected by the people, he's the dictator we have there, that he could really be overthrown, which would give control of those nuclear weapons in Pakistan, put it right into the hands of these Islamic radicals.
Yes, it's probably number one on the crisis list. This is one of the reasons President Bush went out there, to give his support both to India and to Pakistan, try to have them work together on nuclear issues, and beef up the support for Musharraf with the military, their intelligence service, and even some economic development. But Pakistan is definitely a crisis area. Of course, you've also seen what's happening recently between the Sunnis and the Shias in Iraq, which is a tremendous test case for the United States. We also have a non-Arab state, but Muslim, Iran, that we're having tremendous problems with because they're expanding their research on nuclear weapons. And we have some good things. We have good things going on with Turkey, Morocco, Algeria. We have a lot of positive things happening with our old adversary, Libya. But yet, in all of these countries, especially countries like countries like Egypt, countries like Saudi Arabia, there is a growing clandestine terrorist group seeking power.
And I think this really is something everybody has to understand, that all of the existing governments over there are threatened by this growing radical Islamic movement. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mr. Kirk was just talking about the growing influence of the radical Islamic movement within the Islamic world today, which really threatens the stability of the entire area, doesn't it?
Yes, and another area we forget is the problems in Europe, because if you've seen, there were many, many Muslim riots in France. There's been riots all over Europe because of the Danish cartoons, which portrayed Muhammad in what the Islamics think was a very negative light. Demographics in Europe, particularly in countries like Italy, Spain, and France, the Muslim populations are rising up, and there are terrorists in those countries. So it's a challenge not only in the 26 Muslim countries, it's a challenge what's happening in Europe.
Well, Chris, you talk about the terrorist cells, and the terrorist influence that is Europe. It's latent, just waiting to explode. My concern is, do we really have terrorist cells here in America that, should we attack Iran, would be activated? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the definition of terrorism, the people that work terrorism in the United States are the FBI, and they have a National Security Division. And I don't have any particularly inside information, but when you define terrorists, there's about 25 terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, and so on and so forth. The main terrorist groups that are active now are Iranians. They have been here for a while. They have aid from Venezuela. They are very well financed, and they believe that either the United States or Israel is going to attack Iran, so they want to be able to be in a position to conduct operations against the United States within the United States.
And, of course, one of the most interesting things we talked about in the past is the relationship between Iran and Venezuela right here in the Western Hemisphere. Could you develop that? Because I don't think the average individual really understands the significance or the implications of the government of Hugo Chavez.
Well, Chavez was elected democratically. There was an attempted coup against him. He blamed the United States. He is a Marxist. He is worse than a Marxist or even a friend of Fidel Castro. He is an American hater. He's invited not only FARC, Cubans, and Chinese in, he's invited all types of terrorist groups. Al-Qaeda has been training on the Isle of Margarita in a place called Terra Mate 7. Hezbollah is there, and a lot of what we would call no-name terrorist groups. Hamas is lobbying for an office. They visited Chavez a few weeks ago. Chavez has criticized President Bush, Condoleezza Rice. He's threatened the United States. He's threatened to cut our oil off. And a crisis is looming between the United States and Venezuela, equal to the Cuban Missile Crisis back in the early 60s.
Well, of course, if Hugo Chavez were to cut off the oil from the United States, I understand it's something like about 1.7 million barrels a day, which is what, a little over, about 7 or 8% of our oil supply. Now, wouldn't that have a profound impact on our economy, and wouldn't that just run the price of gas, of oil, up to $100 or $125 or $150 a barrel?
Well, it could, but it would also hurt Venezuela. They would stop getting revenue from us. Actually, they're the fourth largest supplier to the United States, and there have been rumors that if we attack Iran and Venezuela will cut oil off to us, and this is really not a very valid threat, okay, because we have tremendous sources of energy now from Mexico, Canada. We're even getting oil from Libya. We're getting oil from Iraq, and the Saudis have said if there is trouble with Iran or even Venezuela, they would make up the difference. Now, Chavez knows this. What Chavez really believes, and he's not a normal leader, he believes that a weapons of mass destruction deployed in the United States would seriously damage us economically. And there's been lots of rumors that he's made statements like if a weapon were to hit the United States, he would go down in history as the man that brought America to its knees. Now, our government knows that. It's been very difficult, however, for our policymakers to design a program against him. He's been democratically elected, so it's very difficult to initiate a covert operation to overthrow him. The CIA does not have the ability to assassinate, and they couldn't keep it secret anyway. So many journalists and staffers on the Hill would probably leak it to the Washington Post or the New York Times. So there was some hope that there would be an opposition to Chavez within the country. However, that opposition is very small. It's completely penetrated by Cuban intelligence, and he knows this. He's very, very street smart, and he poses the greatest threat to America's national security. Not North Korea, not Iran, not even what's happening in Iraq. Because he is so intent on damaging and destroying the United States through helping a covert terrorist group. Not a military action against the United States, but keeping it quiet and trying to seriously damage America.
Well, now, of course, it would be very easy to have some missiles down in Venezuela that could be launched against the United States. And, you know, you mentioned he seems to have a very, very close relationship with the leadership of Iran today.
Yes, he has a very close relationship. A number of months ago, he's invited Iranian nuclear physicists, researchers, and scientists to go into the Venezuelan nuclear reactor facility. It's called IVIC, I-V-I-C. And they have a small reactor. It's capable of producing grade uranium. Plus, there's many, many more Iranians. We don't really know what they're doing all over Venezuela. They could be training. They could be planning. They could be doing business. And he has, we believe, signed a type of non-aggression pact with the Iranians.
Well, I mean, non-aggression, I mean, if you're aggressed against, why, we'll come to your aid?
That's like right. That? Yeah, he'll do something. Maybe it'll be cut off our oil. Maybe he'll try to clandestinely put some type of weapon of mass destruction in a container. We don't really know, but the entire intelligence community is starting to monitor and focus on Venezuela more than ever.
Well, of course, I know that Iran has signed some sort of a pact with Syria. And then, of course, the fellow who heads one of those armies over there, one of the armies in Iraq, seems to be very close to the Iranians as well. So, certainly many of the Iraqi leaders, certainly the Shia leaders, are close to the Shias in Iran. So it looks to me like we've got ourselves into a real can of worms over there.
Well, we have ourselves in a can of worms. We are spread out thin. Negotiations with North Korea over their nuclear plans have basically stalemated. We have trouble in Iraq, like you mentioned. And what Bin Laden did and what the other terrorists have done is they have been inspired to try to obtain a weapons of mass destruction to either use it against Israel or deploy it in the United States. This is their goal. They feel that a nation state like Pakistan or Venezuela doesn't have to do it. But if a state like Pakistan or Venezuela or Iran gives covert assistance to a terrorist group to damage the United States, that's the way to go. That's what they're trying to accomplish.
Well, certainly we carry a book called The Eighth Al-Qaeda Connection by Paul Williams, who has been a frequent guest on our program, and he feels that Al-Qaeda already has a certain number of, maybe they're very, very small, but at least their nuclear weapons, they could be very, very devastating. Do you think there's any truth to that?
I've seen many reports, many books. I've talked to intelligence officers in Muslim countries, our own country, Europe, France, where I've lived for many years. And I think most of the information is that, yes, Al-Qaeda tried to get parts of it, whether they try to get triggering devices or uranium or scientists, a la the Pakistani variety, Mr. Khan, to help them. They were never really able to put it together. They were never really able to buy it from the Chechens in Russia. They tried. I think the estimate is Bin Laden spent $320 million over a 10-year period outside of both when he was in Sudan and Afghanistan, but he was never able to accomplish it. Since then, however, since 2001, since 9/11, there's been a number of what I would call no-name terrorist groups that we haven't put a name on that are trying to get different weapons of mass destruction and trying to get them deployed in the United States.
Well, now, do you think that there is a possibility that there will be some sort of a air attack or Tomahawk or cruise missile attack on the Iranian sites where they're actually enriching the uranium? In other words, do you think that we, somewhere down the line, are going to have a preemptive attack on Iran to prevent them from developing nuclear weapons?
Yes, I think that's probably going to happen. There's been a lot of disinformation around. Saturday I had the opportunity to meet Dr. Ben Gad, who's the consul general here in Miami. And he said Israel feels very safe because Mossad and their intelligence really knows what the Iranians are doing. Now there's lots of rumors. There's rumors that the Israelis actually have special forces within the country. The United States does have two large special forces bases near Iran. Our intelligence regarding Iran is improving, and I think most likely, or rather unlikely, the Israelis would attack. It's a very difficult jaunt. It's like a 4,200-mile round trip between Israel and Iran, and the Israelis would only be able to take out about 50 sites. There's about 460 sites, and the United States would launch cruise and Tomahawk missiles. We would not destroy their cities. We would not destroy their Persian culture. We would not have lots of casualties. We would not have to have troops go in except possibly some commandos that would be dropped in. And our 5 or 6 carrier task forces...
Hold that thought there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. John Quirk. Please pick up the story there. You were saying that our task forces would do what now?
Well, we have about 5 or 6 carrier task forces either in the Persian Gulf or on the way. And they have new, updated, sophisticated cruise and Tomahawk missiles. And they're very accurate. Some of them might be supplemented by some airstrikes with these new developed bunker busters. We also sold the Israelis quite a few of them. But the idea would be to take out the nuclear facilities without having lots of casualties. The other reason for doing it would be a relatively short war, maybe a week, so oil prices would not drop that much. And if the Saudis make up the difference and the Libyans and we stick by our reserves, the world's economy will not suffer that much. The Iranians would have a setback to their nuclear program anywhere from 7 to 20 years, and it would change the nature of the Mideast peace talks, because Israel will never make peace with the Palestinians unless Syria and Iran are removed from the chessboard.
But, of course, do you really think that after we had attacked Iran, and then irreparable, you know, I mean, we might kill a few thousand people. Do you think they're just going to say, well, shucks all, you know, we'll just forget about this? I mean, it seems to me that the Iranian, you know, attitude would be, we're going to get revenge.
Well, they would, and they've done it before. You know, they were behind, you know, we've had a back-and-forth relationship with Iran that's not been good. You know, they took our hostages. We accidentally, supposedly, shot down the Iranian passenger plane.
Right.
They conducted terrorist operations against that in Europe. They killed our diplomats. They fund Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad, who are kind of their hitmen. And they probably, according to my sources, they've developed new intelligence operations, both in Canada and the United States and Europe, to do just what you suggest, to cause some type of terrorist attack against the United States in retaliation.
So, I mean, this would be my fear that, you know, the Arab attitude is, you do it to me, we're going to do it to you. You kill 1,000 of our people, we're going to kill 2,000 of yours. Or sort of tit for tat or pro quo, you know. So, you know, I'm really very, very concerned. Why are we so worried about the Iranians having nuclear weapons when the Pakistanis have them, the Russians have them, the Chinese have them? They're completely surrounded with people with the nuclear weapons. So is there any way you think that we can really indefinitely keep them from getting them? And certainly couldn't they enrich the uranium in South America with Hugo Chavez?
Mm-hmm. We must stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. They are a terrorist state. Pakistan and Russia are not terrorist states. Iran funds all types of terrorism with Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad. They give money to the Syrians. They are a fundamentalist terrorist state. And no one in their right mind, whether it's the UN, who's been somewhat soft on them, or Europe, who's been negotiating with them, would ever conceive of them having nuclear weapons. And I think what's going to happen, Europe is going to come closer to the United States, so is the UN, other international organizations, and they are going to lobby President Bush and lobby Congress, it doesn't have to be the Israelis, to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. And the Iranians have said openly...
Hold that right thought right. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Mr. Quirk has been saying that he feels we're going to have to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons, and he feels Europe is going to drive closer to the United States, and certainly they are going to ask the United Nations to get America to do something. So would that be a fair statement?
Yes, I think the Bush policy is going to be like this. They believe they have egg on their face over Iraq. They have problems in Iraq. We're overextended. So it would be better for Europe to lobby the United States, for the UN to concur, not just through resolutions, but to advocate doing something. And it would, even if Russia and China were to abstain in the Security Council. And then, of course, Israel has a concern. And I think what's going to happen, members of Congress would lobby Bush and pressure Bush to do something. And I think that's what the Bush policy is going to be. Probably you'll start to see that after the November elections.
So we would have, you know, I guess about, 7 or 8 months now before anything serious would happen. You know, because the implications of this really, certainly, I would think that they would try to target our economy.
Yes, I think that's what the Iranians, through through their intelligence service, have done a number of analytical reports that they want to panic Americans in two ways. If there's a possibility of domestic conventional terrorist attacks against our shopping centers and against icons like our monuments, to panic Americans, or there is a possibility that they would try to deploy some type of weapons of mass destruction here. It could be biological, could be chemical, or it could be nuclear if they have a nuclear weapon already.
All right, so you are concerned about that. Do you think that our anti-terrorist forces here, officials, are concerned about the possibility then of true domestic terrorism if we attack Iran? In other words, they would have to be prepared to handle that should it occur?
Yes, I think that, you know, unfortunately, American foreign policy is always reactive. I mean, we have to be attacked at Pearl Harbor before we do something. We have to be attacked at the World Trade Center before we do anything. But now our domestic intelligence services are targeting as best they can any kind of terrorist relationship in the United States, trying to cross the border, trying to get in through maritime ports and so on and so forth. And our military, which is second to none, is ready to take action. And this is the thing that a Chavez would be afraid of, the retaliatory strike of the United States, if we had enough intelligence to prove that he was trying to do something. And of course, Iran has already been warned by both France several times and Israel that both France and Israel have the possibility of using nuclear weapons in a preemptive strike against Iran. And Iran has had that message loud and clear.
But, of course, isn't this a rather frightening thing to think of, a preemptive nuclear strike? I mean, especially if Pakistan should topple, why, and those missiles in Pakistan should fall into the hands of, you know, of the Islamic terrorists. They would be able to shoot them at France and at Germany and create a nuclear holocaust there.
Yes, I mean, it's very, very scary. The only good thing about Pakistan, Musharraf, with American help and the help of Indian intelligence, has really weeded out a lot of the fundamentalists in the Pakistani intelligence service, ISI, and the military. And things are getting better and better there.
I know that, well, it's Musharraf is actually working with Indian intelligence to get the radicals out of his own government?
Yes, Indian intelligence is a first-class intelligence service, and of course Musharraf and the Pakistani military would be worried, because the Pakistanis, remember a few years ago, Pakistan and India almost went at it. The United States, Richard Armitage, went out there and settled it, and everybody stood down, but it was very, very scary between Pakistan and India. They were threatening to use nuclear weapons with each other. And the danger is, if Musharraf was ever assassinated by a fundamentalist group or there was a takeover, India would launch an attack probably right away. They would not wait. They would attack.
I mean, India would attack Pakistan, and Then, of course, Pakistan would retaliate by attacking India.
They could.
And it really sounds like they're really sort of sitting on a tinderbox over there. And I think that Americans really have to understand, I think the whole world is a tinderbox right now. And I really tremble for my country when I reflect what's going on. And we're going to be back here in just a moment with Mr. John Quirk as we explore this, what's really going on in the world. And, of course, Mr. Quirk has contact with many intelligence agencies and government leaders, and so he can speak with a certain amount of certainty things about that you're not ordinarily going to hear on most programs right here in the United States. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. I guess this afternoon is Mr. John Quirk. And when we get back here and the stations are all back, we'll get the website out and more information. But one of the things that's really quite disconcerting is what's happening in South America. And certainly we see a rather radical left working in Brazil and in so many of the South American countries. Country after country now, Bolivia has been taken over by the Marxists. And so isn't there really a growing a socialist or Marxist or pro-communist a movement all throughout South America?
Yes, and the reason is, I mean, the United States spent its national treasury fighting Castro and the Russians in the 70s, and we did a great job, and we started building democracy in all of those countries. What has overcome democracy and capitalism in some of the countries, not all, is corruption and poverty. Those countries have tremendous poverty and tremendous corruption. And that's a catalyst for any kind of screwball that comes along that says he's got a populist revolution like Chavez or a Marxist or whatever. And in these countries, it is spreading. And Chavez is spreading it. He's taking advantage of poverty and corruption, and he's instituting his own form of Marxist communism. I'm not sure he's even read a book on Marx, but you're seeing in Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, Brazil, and Venezuela the beginnings of a very solid, almost non-alignment Marxist group. Chavez is also fostering trouble in Panama. He's giving money to the labor unions and the student groups. He's funded Ortega in Nicaragua. He's funding divergent military officers in Mexico and Ecuador, even in Argentina. He's building a massive radio station, television and radio station, and the main theme is anti-Americanism, anti-imperialism. And he wants to be the person not only to wipe out what he calls imperialism in Latin America, but he wants to wipe out America. And he's done very little to alleviate the problems of poverty or the poor. His Chavista movement, like communism, is a fraud. And but he's buying billions of dollars in weapons. He's beefing up Castro. He ships him 60,000 barrels of oil a day. He gives them money. The Venezuelans have established a bank there. And they've let more and more cocaine traffic through Colombia.
Hold that thought, right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John was just saying that certainly the Chavez is allowing the drug traffic to actually increase, and the drugs are flowing into his country. And then what is he doing? And they are sort of a transshipping site where the drugs come into Venezuela, and then, of course, they come into America and other countries?
Yes, he's permitted FARC, the drug cartel, to have 80 to 150 people. They're based at the Grand Malia Hotel in Caracas. They money launder. They travel on Venezuelan passports. And let me make a point that Chavez is very smart. He made a statement that Americans like cocaine. We're the users. He's absolutely right. He makes a statement that there is tremendous corruption in other Latin American corrupt countries. He's somewhat right. And he makes a statement that there's poverty all over. But what he's doing, he's blaming the United States for all of that. If he believed in what he really says he believes in, he would do things to stop. He's kicked the DEA out. They monitor our FBI, CIA operatives in the country. The DEA was supplying a lot of intelligence. He kicked them out, brought them back in, kicked them out again. There's rumors he's going to kick all of our attachés out in the next few months. So it's not a matter of foreign policy with him or ideology to a certain extent. His ideology, even more than Marxism, is hating America. So he's going to do everything he possibly can to damage America, move more drugs into the country, invite more Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah into the country, sign more agreements with China and the Iranians, our adversaries. He just bought $3 billion worth of Russian equipment. So he is the main problem in Latin America.
Well, how about Lula? Is it Lulu or Lula?
Lula. That's his nickname. He's a socialist, but he's not as radical as Hugo Chavez, and he doesn't have the money or the ability to spread a Marxist philosophy to other countries. Now, Evo Morales in Bolivia, as you know, was a drug dealer. I mean, he represented the cocaine dealers. He is completely in bed with Chavez. About 5 days after he was elected president, he came on and he said, "I'm going to be America's worst nightmare." And he confounded that by inviting Cuban intelligence in to run his political campaign, to run his intelligence service, and give his advice to his military. So it's following the same pattern that Chavez has done.
Well, that really sounds like sort of a gruesome threesome down there with Lula and certainly the Bolivian leader and Chavez, and there are others down there as well. How are we possibly going to be able to handle that? Since, at least apparently, they all were democratically elected, and certainly our government wouldn't do anything to oppose democracy, would we?
No, and what the problem that we're doing, we're actually disengaging from Latin America. And there's several reasons for that. One of the main reasons is that we're going to start disengaging and downsizing SOUTHCOM, which is our big military base in South Florida, and building up PACCOM, which is our base in the Pacific. The reason we're doing that is to challenge the Chinese, who finally the State Department and all of our policymakers, CIA, FBI, State, Commerce Department, outside organizations that lobby have finally decided China is our adversary.
Well, but we've been building them up for years. We've been transferring military technology to them. We gave them the technology so that they could burb their missiles and get pinpoint accuracy with their missiles so that they could give it to North Korea, so they could give it to Iran, so they could target Europe. Why would we have been so stupid to give them our highest military secrets? Doesn't make sense.
Well, there's two reasons for that. The Clinton administration permitted that technology transfer, never a Republican administration. And the second reason is that there are no Department of Commerce really restrictions on technology transfer with the Chinese like they were with the Russians. American businessmen are very greedy. They produce everything in China. The Chinese steal us blind. They've set up strategic agreements and joint ventures, and they have technology transfer centers, and it's almost impossible to stop them from stealing the high target areas, like you said, military, microchips, command and control situations, and so on and so forth. And the Chinese beat our brains out when it comes to espionage, and we've had very, very few prosecutions against them.
And you have to ask yourself why, and they've had a couple, and they've almost, like the government, threw the cases, like they weren't that interested in the convictions. And yet, of course, I see, potentially, China becoming our major adversary in the world, or one of our major adversaries, and, of course, we've done everything to build up their military. So we've certainly made some very poor judgments there, wouldn't you agree?
I think we made some poor judgments, but I don't think we can be real hard on ourselves in that area. The Chinese are like a juggernaut. In the United States, in its policymaking group, we have some very smart people in our National Security Council. And I think when we look at China, to a certain extent, we're benefiting. They're buying a lot of treasury bonds, and they're financing our debt. You can go into Walmart or Home Depot and buy something really cheap. It benefits the United States. The big problem we have with China is that their foreign policy is to push us out of the Pacific, and we're not going. So we're starting to almost develop, I hate to use the word, a containment policy. We're probably going to go back into the Philippines. We'll probably have a relationship with Vietnam. We'll probably build up PACCOM in Hawaii and Guam and Okinawa. The Japanese today are very much on our side, but 80% of their manufacturing is in China. You don't know how they're going to behave in 10 years. So right now, our response to China is we're not going to let you push us out of the Pacific. China's response is, you know what, we're going to build up a blue water navy to challenge America, and we're going to build up a huge coterie of missiles that could hit the West Coast probably in 2 years. So the Bush administration is expanding its missile defense plan. And all of this is costing us trillions and trillions of dollars.
No, but it's trillions and trillions of dollars we don't have because we're giving it away. We, you know, the amount of money that they're wasting on welfare and giving to other countries, where is the money coming from?
Well, we're $400 billion in debt on Iraq. It's going to cost $180 billion more. Of certain weapon systems that are being developed that are secret, not only the missile defense plan, but state-of-the-art, America's always done, state-of-the-art airplanes and missiles and submarines. That's costing trillions more. But we are a very wealthy country. The economy has not gone down like people thought it would. And we just have to keep doing it. We don't have an alternative. The world is just too dangerous a place.
Well, you know, one of the things, now, I believe in tax cuts, but how can you cut taxes and increase spending? That just doesn't seem very logical.
Well, I'm not an economic expert, but I think what's probably going to happen from everything, you're going to see the housing market burst, except maybe out where you are in Northern California, that's always strong. You'll probably see interest rates go up. It'll control inflation. Unemployment is still very, very well. But if the United States economy goes down, every other economy is going to go down. China's economy, Latin America, and Europe. So they won't have the revenue to keep producing military things. So we're in what I would call a conundrum. No one knows where we're going in terms of Iraq, or a war with Iran, or a challenge from Chavez, or a challenge from North Korea. But what I do know is that American business and research and development are stronger than ever, and that's what fuels our economy.
And certainly the economy at least would appear to be doing fairly well, although I was just reading now the fourth auto part, multi-billion dollar corporation has just declared for bankruptcy. You know, the data, there's three others before them, Delphi and three others. So, you know, certainly our economy appears to be doing fairly well. And yet when we see General Motors talking about bankruptcy, when we see Ford talking about bankruptcy, when we see a number of our airlines going into a receivership, or at least threatening to, I wonder how strong our economy really is.
Well, I don't think Ford is going to go bankrupt and General Motors isn't. We've had this problem before with a challenge from the Japanese a number of years ago. They have very smart people at GM and Ford. They're going to retool, they'll have a new business plan, and they'll come out with new models that will challenge the Japanese.
Well, will they
and
be
the Chinese.
Will they be built here or be built in China?
Well, that's the big problem, isn't it? It's this constant outsourcing to China, to India. To tell you the truth, I was a little shocked when President Bush rather advocated outsourcing to the Indians when we have a lot of people here that are out of work. What I think the United States will do and has to do is retrain people for new industries in either software or computers, and I think we have the ability to do that. You know, we're the only country in the world, Europeans are always amazed by this, that people in America keep going back to school. They go back to school for adult education. When they're in their 50s and 60s, they get law degrees and so on and so forth. And part of that is our whole research and development culture, and that's what keeps us way ahead of Europe and China and Russia. Constant development of a new microchip or a new computer or a Bill Gates coming along, and the United States is still very, very far ahead of everybody in those areas.
And certainly we have been in the past. What do you think about the impact of India? Because I understand they have a tremendous electronic industry over there. In fact, they are trying to challenge Silicon Valley here.
Well, from all my friends in Silicon Valley, and I know people in parts and development, they're expecting a huge boom, and again, it'll be a generation ahead of the Indians, okay? And a lot of the jobs that the Indians have taken out of Silicon Valley and other parts of the United States are for telephone servicing, software development, and so on and so forth. The United States kind of passed that by a few years ago. We're in a whole new genre of technology that we're developing. I think the best thing about the relationship between India and America, India is the largest democracy. It'll challenge China as a superpower. It'll help us keep an eye on both Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it's continuing to prosper and develop, which, you know, 50 years ago, millions and millions of people were starving to death. And that is not the case now in India.
No, they've got well over a billion people over there. That's between India and China, where that's almost half the world's population.
Mm-hmm. And the China fear them. The China is afraid of them.
Well, I remember so well, of course I don't remember it, but I've read that it was Napoleon who said, you know, let China sleep for when China wakes, why the world will tremble. Mm-hmm. I may even want to apply that someday to India as well.
Mm-hmm. I think the problem with China is that they're not democratizing. In American culture, we love capitalism and democracy. And here you have a situation where they're moving into capitalism, but they have no intentions of democratizing. And that presents a challenge because the military and the intelligence services in China are in the background of the business community. You never see them, but they really call the shots when it comes to national security and defense in China. And they want to dominate the world. There's no doubt about it.
And I really think that they do. I think they want hegemony over all of Asia. And they're, I believe, are building up their navy so that they can challenge us, aren't they?
Yes, and their first step is what they're doing right now. They want to control the shipping lanes. They've just signed agreements with the CARICOM countries, Bahamas, Jamaica, Grenada, Barbados, a couple others I forget. And they are rebuilding their port facilities. They're putting huge container port facilities. There's one in Freeport. They're building another one in Nassau. And they're building two mega ports, one in LaGuardia, one in Maracaibo in Venezuela. They basically control both ends of the Panama Canal through their company, Hutchinson Wompa. So they want to control the shipping lanes of the world. Then they want to control the port facilities. Then it'll be easier for them, not only for their maritime, their merchant marine to come in, which is all over the world, and their containers, then their warships will be able to travel all over the world. They can't do that now.
But, of course, what you're really describing is all these shipping centers in the Caribbean. It's almost like they're beginning to surround America.
Well, they are, and it's all part of their whole plan. I mean, they're gifting a tremendous Olympic stadium to the Bahamas. They fly free of charge people from the Caribbean and Latin America back to China. They're winning the hearts and minds. They're building hospitals and schools in Barbados. Grenada just opened relationships with them. So they're very, very smart, and their trade with Latin America is increasing dramatically.
And this is true with both Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela?
Every country in Latin America, the trade is almost, I would say, increasing 30 to 40% every year. Yeah. And China is putting on more trade shows. They're going into all these countries, manufacturing, and so on and so forth.
And, of course, China is really having a tremendous impact upon manufacturing in Europe, aren't they? It's very difficult for them to compete, at least with many of the products that they're producing.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Europe is a major textile producer, and the Chinese are beating their brains out. And what the Europeans, they react like they react against the United States. They have trade wars or protectionism, and it's not going to work. And then yet, on the other hand, the European governments have invited thousands of Chinese in to learn French and German and so on and so forth. So it's really a different situation. No one knows what's going to happen, but I would say we'll probably start to have crises with China in the next 5 to 10 years, especially if they don't democratize.
Well, of course, I hope that you're right, that we have 5 to 10 years before where we do begin to see these crises, because certainly China is taking so many of our major industries. I'm talking about our major manufacturing. And what about their electronic industry? Are they trying? We know that many of the chips, Intel's chips, are made over there, aren't they?
Used to be made here. they're made there, and many of these little devices that go in your computer are made in China, these Lexar Media jump drives that you stick in your computer. But they make everything. They make shower doors, they make ammunition, they make counterfeit videos and shirts. They make everything, including bicycles and so on. But they have a lot of problems. They have a lot of problems when it comes to land and water and air pollution. And it's not a fait accompli they're going to be the major superpower. A lot of people think they will, but it's not definite yet.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment to let's get your telephone number and your website out, please.
Okay, my website is www.diplomaticacademy.org, and my email is irgglobal@aol.com.
irgglobal@aol.com. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's been Mr. John Quirk, and we've got about 3 minutes before we have to let you go. Is there any other major issue you'd like to cover? Because we've covered almost the whole world in this
yes.
in 1 hour.
Well, I think, you know, I'm an optimist, and I think you're going to start to see Europe come back into the fold. I think that you're going to start to see tremendous lobbying to reform the United Nations, which has been traditionally against America. What I'd like to say is we're in a world of what I call the four C's, with adversaries and allies: competition, cooperation on some issues, crisis, and conflict. And we're going to have that with allies as well as adversaries. And the main thing that solves these problems is negotiation and diplomacy. And I believe the United States is the leader of the free world. It's taken a lot of hits now. There's a lot of anti-Americanism. But the real future is following America's way and not being a defeatist or giving up. I think America's way, through our religious values, our morals, and what we stand for, what the Founding Fathers stand for, is what deep down most people in the world want. And it's simple. It's called freedom.
Oh, I'm sure this is absolutely right. You know, of course, my concern is that a lot of people, you know, see what's going on, and they see whether it's justified or not. That, you know, all the propaganda that comes out about Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, and they really, many of them really believe that America really does condone torture and this sort of thing. How can we counter that that feeling, this belief that is growing in people throughout the world, that America no longer holds to those values that once made us a great and noble country?
Well, you're right. It is a problem, and I think the media expands on that. And the left in this country, the extreme left, is never dead. They're constantly denigrating our values here and overseas, especially some of the people that come out of Hollywood, not all of them, but they travel around the world, and they basically denigrate the United States. But if you look at the Iraq War, there's no major anti-Vietnam type movement. Most of the college people at universities are focused on getting a degree and a good job, and this is the difference. In America, somebody can graduate from a community college and get a job and have an apartment and a nice car in about a year and a half. In Europe, they can go to school for 10 years and get out and never have a very good job. So it just shows our economy and our system is so dynamic.
So we're out of time, John. Thank you so very much for being with us, and God
bless. My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Mr. John Quirk. And we try to find interesting guests. John Quirk is a fascinating individual, and we didn't have time really to go into his background, but he's got connections throughout the entire world, and I would pay a certain amount of attention and give a great deal of credence to much of what he says. Well, of course, as you well know, I believe we're involved in a spiritual battle, because if you look at things logically, so much of what's going on really doesn't make sense. If you understand we're involved in a spiritual battle, what is being played on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield, then many of the things that we're seeing do begin to make sense. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and of course we have it in video, we have it on DVD. It's a good primer to understand what's going on. And then, of course, we have another wonderful tool. It's Chris Pinto's great new DVD. It's called The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and really beautifully done to bring out the fact that there really are secret societies. You'll see their temple over in San Jose. You'll see one of their headquarters in Southern California in San Jose. It's, of course, the Rosicrucian Temple in Los Angeles. It's the Philosophical Research a foundation down there, and of course they have comparable places all over this country where people who are adepts of the secret societies meet and of course plot their plan for the New World Order and the New World Religion. So, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, my DVD and or book, Brotherhood of Darkness, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. We recommend certainly our new talk. It's a video. It's called World Revolution. It contains my interview back in 1980 with the American ambassador to Cuba who'd been there during the time of the revolution. He will tell you how the American government intentionally brought Fidel Castro to power knowing he was a communist. Now, why would we do something like that? Why do we do so many of the things that are going on today that just don't make sense? There has to be another explanation. So we hope many of you will really enjoy this World Revolution. And, of course, we have our DVD and or video entitled Planned Population Reduction. I mean, here in America, we have 60 million Americans with a sexually transmitted viral disease. Is that a failed public health policy? Or is it a successful genocidal policy to discourage population reproduction? How could you do such a poor job unintentionally? 500,000 people dead from AIDS and other people, 1 million people infected. Why we're concerned when a couple of people get measles, but we're not really concerned about AIDS. If you haven't read my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, you need to get it. It's still the classic book on the AIDS epidemic, and then, of course, the book we've kept in print for so many years, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. That's Foundations of Power and Influence, going into how the great tax-exempt foundations finance communism and finance socialism and finance to take over our universities and how they interlock with the Council on Foreign Relations, which is America's invisible government. I know I've been through their headquarters, I've been through their secret records, but that's a subject for another talk. Although we do have a four-tape set called The Secret Government, and, of course, there you'll have my interview with Norman Dodd back in 1980, the interview with Professor Carol Quigley, and, of course, my talk on geopolitics. That's a secret government four-tape set, and there's so much more. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Our website is RadioLiberty.com, RadioLiberty.com, where you can listen to our programs live. You can listen to them on the Internet, and, of course, you can hear them there on delayed. You can hear them on MP3, and, of course, link up with our other sites all across America. You can hear us on shortwave, and Telstar 5 satellite does a great job of pulling us down. Remember, we do carry the Berkey products, and if you'd like to get one, and if you get either the Big Berkey or Berkey Light through Radio Liberty, where you get a four-tape set or one of the videos we produced without charge. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, we're going to lose this country. And finally, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.